I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imagine inching your way straight up a mountainside with 100 pounds of gear on your back, over gaping crevasses and treacherous, crumbly stretches of ice, your lungs gasping for air in the thin oxygen of Mount Everest. Or imagine yourself biking and rock climbing and trekking, kayaking, whitewater rafting and orienteering for 457 miles through the Sierra Nevadas in a primal quest adventure race. Got it? Okay, now imagine doing all that with your eyes closed. When Eric Weinmayer became the first blind person to conquer Everest in June of 2001, no one was more surprised than some of his fellow mountaineers. After all, Everest is the top of the world. Nearly 90% of those who attempt to conquer it don't make it. And close to 200 people have died trying since 1953. What made this blind guy think he could do it is what we're talking about this hour. And here's the question to you. Where does the nerve, the drive, come from to push someone to achieve extraordinary things? What transforms adversity into inspiration? Or conversely, is there something to be said for steering clear of the record books and focusing instead on smaller, everyday personal bests? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Eric Weinmayer joins us now in our Boston studio. Welcome.
Good morning.
It's good to have you here.
Thanks.
Your life story does make me wonder, what do you think you'd be doing now if you still had your sight?
Well, I think that's interesting because, you know, I think blindness is maybe what happens to you, but your character maybe enables you to push beyond that and create a life that you want for yourself. But I will say this, I think that if I had never gone blind, I'd still be playing baseball and basketball and doing the things that I like to do when I could see. It was only when I went blind and I was forced to sort of reach out and find new things that I still thought I'd be able to do was when I found rock climbing. And I went as part of a recreational program for blind kids. My dad sort of pushed me into the program, and they were taking blind kids out rock climbing and tandem biking. And when I went rock climbing and I touched the rock and I found that I could use my hands and feet like eyes to feel my way up the rock and problem solve my way from one hold to the next, and I could do it without my sight, I thought, this is the most engaging thing I've ever done since I'd gone blind.
That's right, because your father first noticed as a baby that there seemed to be a problem with your eyes focusing. And you actually had some sight until what age?
I was 13 when I totally went blind. I could see well enough to ride a bike and to live a sort of relatively normal life as a kid. I could play basketball if friends bounced past passes to me. I was legally blind, though, so I was always, you know, in a legal way, I was blind.
I think about the fierce protectiveness of parents. You're a father now, so I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. How was it that yours were able to let you learn what you needed to without hovering too much? I mean, you describe your father as the broom and your mother as the dustpan.
Yeah, my parents weren't ever given any kind of textbook or any kind of formula of how to deal with a blind kid. They were just sort of figuring it out as they went along. My mom was super protective, and didn't want me to be hurt. And you know, we went around from doctor to doctor for years and years. You know, at amazing facilities, you know, like Mass Eye and Ear or hospitals all around the country, trying to figure out, you know, how I could get some sight back or how we could stop me from going blind. And eventually we wound up with a doctor named Dr. Brockhurst, who said, diagnosed me with this very rare eye disease called retinaschisis. And he said, you'll be blind at 13 and there's nothing we can really do. And at that point, I think my parents had to accept it. And I didn't know what blindness meant, but the way people reacted, it was as close to what I imagine, you know, somebody saying you're going to die. That's what I mean. It felt like like what I would imagine dying would feel like, because it was like this terrible thing that was looming over my head that I knew was going to catch up to me at some point.
And what did you mean by that broom and dustpan analogy?
Well, my dad was amazing because he'd always sweep me out. You know, he'd always push me out there, say, try this, you know, try that. It's okay if you flop on your face. And my mom would then, you know, after I shattered into a million pieces, she'd sweep me up and she'd put me back together again like moms do. And my dad was, he gave me sort of a great philosophy of how to live, which was always to try to not be a barrier, but to try to figure out ways of pushing through things. And for instance, when I was a kid, I loved to ride my bike down my driveway. It was a steep hill, and I'd hit this ramp with my bike, and I'd fly across, you know, through the air maybe 10 or 15 feet, and I'd land on this landing ramp that I'd built. And at one point, I couldn't see the ramp well enough because I was losing vision. And he instead of telling me no more jumping your bike, which I would have probably done anyway, he took out his spray paint and he spray painted this very bright orange, and I was able to see it for probably 6 more months before, you know, I went totally blind. And it was just that kind of thinking, you know, trying to think beyond. I've always used that in my climbing.
And what was it, you mentioned a moment ago about at age 16 discovering climbing, what was it about that that was such a profound experience for you?
What was neat about rock climbing for me was the fact that there was no ball, little balls zipping through the air ready to just crack you in the head. I mean, the rock, if you can believe it, it doesn't move. It's stationary. Your body is dynamic. So it's one of these sports where you have to use your body in a fluid way to kind of, you know, getting your body to move into all these crazy positions in order to get from point A to point B to point C. And I'm feeling and scanning my way up the rock. And it was just, when you're climbing, I wasn't thinking about anything else. I was just thinking about how to get up that rock. And I loved it so much. I mean, the texture of the rocks under my hands, the patterns of hot and cold. When I got up high on the rock, I remember I could hear for the first time this beautiful sound of space, of actual sound vibrations that move through space and bounce off of objects and come back at you. I'd never felt that from such a high point before. And I just thought, you know, I guess I had worried that, you know, going blind, your life, your sort of your adventurous part of your life is over. But climbing taught me that it's not.
Mm. You know, for many people who climb, the real payoff is making your way up to the top and looking down to see how far you've come and to really feel great about that. So what's the payoff for you? I mean,
well, I think I don't buy it. I know I'm biased because I'm blind, but if you like a view so much from a summit, I mean, just get yourself a postcard of the summit and save yourself some work. I don't think it's about the view. A lot of times, sighted person, you're looking down through a sea of clouds, or you summit in a whiteout. And then I wonder to myself, why do people climb the hardest routes up a mountain? Why don't they just go up the easiest way if it's just about the view? There's something about climbing that's sort of built into our genetic makeup, I think, as human beings. We want to climb. We want to stand on top. You know, it's the same thing that makes us sort of, I guess, build skyscrapers and do all the things we do as human beings. It's a powerful feeling. I don't believe, though, in sort of conquering mountains, because you learn very quickly as a climber, and I learned very quickly going blind, that there are things out there that are more powerful than us. And you know, if you go head to head with a storm, the strongest person on the face of the earth is going to lose. So you have to sort of learn to work with the rules of the mountains. And I love that. I love that sort of feeling of being connected with the world and having to sort of work through certain rules. And you sneak up to the summit when the mountain blinks.
Have you been surprised and perhaps a little disheartened by some of your fellow climbers who really didn't think you could do it? I mean, I wonder if that comes from their fears of their own abilities being diminished by your accomplishments. You know, well, it can't be that hard to climb Everest because look at this blind guy who did it.
Yeah, when people make comments, I think it's very hard for them to separate their own experiences and their own perceptions with reality. It's everything so mixed up. I mean, I guess when I went to climb my first tall mountain, Mount McKinley in Alaska, people said, wow, I mean, you're carrying huge amounts of weight. You know, it's a long, hard trip. I don't think a blind person would have much of a chance. And after I did that, you know, they said, oh, I don't think you could climb the tallest peak in South America because it's so rocky. It's not snowy. You know, you have to know where to step, and on and on and on. And when I finally got to Everest and thought about it, you know, again, you know, I talked about it and people heard about the idea. Lots of people said, you know, there's no way, a blind person has no business being on a mountain like that. He's going to create some huge disaster. There's going to be an epic, you know, meaning everyone's going to be drawn into a big rescue. And I didn't believe that because I've never seen myself as some kind of crazy risk taker, like some kind of blind Evel Knievel character. I've always seen myself as a problem solver. I try to figure things out that maybe people see as improbable, but I'll figure out a way to do it. And it usually involves a good group of people around me, tons of preparation, and lots of sort of systems that I create in the outdoors. You know, how to hike, how to climb being blind, how to stay safe, how to move fast. And so I thought I had as good a chance as anyone else on that mountain. But I did think, what do these people know that I don't? Maybe there is something up there that I'm just not prepared for. Hmm. And so you always have those doubts in your mind. I mean, you know, it's I've learned that it's okay to, you know, a lot of times you're just pushing through a lot of fear, a lot of doubt, and that's the way it is. That uncertainty is part of everything you do. There's no way to avoid it.
I want to get more fully into your Mount Everest experience a little later, but as you go around the country, you have a problem with the even I people. You know, what is that all about? Who are these people, and why does that make you kind of shake your head?
That story got out because when I was on the cover of Time magazine after the Everest climb, and I was sort of feeling pretty happy and bold after the climb, and I told the reporter from Time magazine about the even I syndrome, and it's gotten all over the place now. And basically I said, you know, it's funny because I'll be in like Iowa speaking to some group and some guy will say, you know, I wouldn't try Mount Everest. And I can see, I have perfectly, you know, good eyes. It's like, you know, even I wouldn't climb Mount Everest. And I think, well, yeah, because maybe, you know, you smoke cigarettes. Maybe you've never been, you've never climbed a mountain. You've never, you know, you never worked out. You never learned all the things that I've learned. I mean, it's sort of this funny presumption that, you know, eyes make you successful, and without eyes, you can't be successful. It's like, you know, there are 100 different things that enable you to get to the top of high mountains, and your sight's just one of them. It's not the ultimate determination of success or failure.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. For some, adversity is a roadblock, and for others, like my guest Eric Weinmayer, it was a cue to leave self-pity behind and live fully. What drives that kind of determination? Is it created by adversity, or is it there in spite of it? 1-800-423-8255 is our telephone number. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Even before he lost his eyesight as a boy, Eric Weinmayer's parents encouraged him to aim high, but they probably never imagined that one day he'd be climbing Mount Everest. Eric Weinmayer joins me now in the studio to talk about that long climb, metaphorically and otherwise. But first, Connection listeners, we want to give you a sense of what it feels like to be there at the top of the world. This is a clip from the documentary Farther Than the Eye Can See. You can hear the wind howling as Eric is warned by a Sherpa guide over the shortwave radio about how quickly the weather's changing. And he's also guided by his fellow climbers up a particularly harrowing path.
We're still waiting for the weather, but the weather is very bad. Windy, snowing, and very difficult.
Straight down. To your left a little bit. To your left. There you go. Straight toward me.
And this is your chance, listeners, to speak with Eric at 1-800-423-8255. And I guess, Eric, we can certainly hear the wind there, so I can get a sense of what that's like.
I and follow someone with the bell that you heard
there. Yes, I wanted to ask about that.
It's jingling, so I can hear them in front of me. They'll jingle it to the left if they want me to move left or to the right, or they'll tap a rock. The problem is that when the wind gets so high, sometimes it blows, it freezes the bell, or it just, you can't hear it. And at that point, I'm just following the sound of crampons, which are the spikes you wear under your boots, squeaking in the snow. Somebody will, they'll sometimes, if they pass rocks, they'll bang their ice axe against rocks. You're hearing these little glimmers of sound in front of you, I was trying to follow them. And then when you get up high, and it's really steep on Everest, it's so steep, you're leaning right into the slope, and you're moving at such a snail's pace that, you know, it's almost like everyone's blind.
And why can't you just talk to each other? Is it the wind just kind of whips the words away, or is it just too difficult because you're focusing on what you're doing?
Well, it's very hard to talk to each other at altitude because everyone, sighted or blind, you're struggling for air. And then when you get up really high, most people go on to bottled oxygen. You have an oxygen mask over you. And that makes you feel sort of like, imagine going and running a marathon with a plastic bag over your head. You're trying to just barely hang on and keep your breathing under control. You're sometimes taking, I know that when I was at the very top of Everest, I was taking 6 breaths between each step. So it's hard to think about other people. And the unusual part of our climb was the fact that my friends had to still guide me at that altitude.
And in fact, the first day, your friends were pretty concerned that you might have bitten off a bit more than you could chew here, because it took you, 13 hours to get to the base camp, and they thought it was only going to be about 6 or 7?
Yeah, the first time it takes you maybe 5 to 8 hours to get through the ice fall. The ice fall is right above base camp, and I believe it's the absolute worst, most chaotic terrain on the face of the earth. I mean, it doesn't meet Americans with Disability Act requirements. It's just absolutely horrendous. I mean, imagine a river of ice that's the glacier runs down the mountain and it collapses down a cliff, and there are boulders of ice of every size imaginable just tumbled and collapsing in this 2,000-foot section called the ice fall, and you have to weave and navigate through it. It's like a labyrinth of ice.
And are you navigating yourself? I mean, are you listening and tapping the ice, or
exactly,
are you being guided at this point?
I have these long poles and a long ice axe, and I'm feeling my way through it. And my friends are kind of talking the unusual parts as we move along. Now, normally, if you're just climbing like a steep ice face, we're all sort of even. But in this kind of terrain where every step is different, my friends are trying to tell me where to step, because you have to step in these little chipped out boot marks that people have stepped in before you. If you step anywhere else, you'll go through a crevasse or through a snow bridge into a crevasse. A lot of times you're jumping across crevasses and I can't feel the other side with my poles. My friends are tapping the other side where you need to land. And, you know, you got to land right in those boot marks. A lot of times there are ladders, 4, 5, 6, 7 ladders lashed together that are spanning these huge crevasses, and I had to learn to cross those. It was rough, and that first trip through 13 hours, it was just twice the amount of time that most people take and twice the risk of having ice fall on top of you and crush you. So it was, when I got above it finally, I was trashed, and I couldn't imagine crossing through it 5 or 6 or even 10 more times, which it takes to acclimatize and to get loads up to your higher camps.
Right. So you had to do that. I mean, one of the things that I didn't understand, I thought you sort of start at the bottom and gradually make your way up. And it's actually, you go up a little, you go down a little, right?
Yeah. And I had worried, you're acclimatizing. You're going up and down and up and down. You probably climb the mountain 3 or 4 times once you're finished. And I had worried, you know, even when you get acclimatized above 26,000 feet, you're in what's called the death zone, where you can't think very well. Your brain becomes a little bit reptilian. And I worry that, you know, as a blind person, I'm always thinking about my steps, and I'm always thinking about whether I'm warm or cold. I'm thinking about the person in front of me. I know it takes a lot more effort to know where to step, to feel where to step. And I thought, you know, if you can't think and you can't see, you know, that might be an overwhelming combination. Mm-hmm. I was always, that fear was always in the back of my mind.
Understandably so. Let's go to one of our listeners now, to Nags Head, North Carolina, and hear from Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Yeah, I guess my question is, I like to meditate, and when I have my eyes closed, I see things in the dark, I guess, kind of, I guess, in your mind's eye. What do you see when you're climbing? And I guess I see in parentheses marks, but what do you see in your mind's eye in the darkness when you're climbing?
Well, I do try to picture the terrain in front of me, because even though I'm blind, I think spatially. So I think of the mountain, I think of the route in front of me. And before Everest, we went to the American Alpine Club, and we actually felt this huge tactile representation of Everest in the Khumbu region of Nepal. And I felt it all. So I had an idea every spot I was on the mountain where I was as in terms of a map, like an overview of it. And I also use my ears to listen to those sound vibrations bouncing off of objects and coming back at me. So I can hear objects and boulders and cliffs, and I can hear drop-offs, I can hear open space. And so I use that, and I create this sort of visual picture in my mind. I can never see very well, so it's sort of it's not a very detailed picture, but it just helps me move through space better.
Interesting point, Mike. Thanks for the call. The other thing that's so fascinating about this is that overnight things change. I mean, you may have a fairly good sense of what you're anticipating for the next day, and then you step out of your tent and, whew, this is a whole new world out there because of the weather.
Yeah, Everest, I mean, it's funny. You could climb Everest if you had perfect weather every day. Lots of people could get to the top, but that's not the way it is. You have these afternoon storms that come in, and it's they're huge storms. And sometimes the wind's blowing at 200 miles an hour on the summit. I knew I didn't want to go to the summit in those kind of conditions. And then down low, sometimes as later in the season, the crevasses open up. The icefall starts really collapsing and tumbling. Avalanches are just pouring down from every wall. And then the monsoons start, and it snows and snows. We were ready to summit. We were in position at Camp 2 to summit when it started snowing. And it snowed, you know, 2 or 3 feet, making the avalanche conditions just horrendous. And there's absolutely nothing to do but to go down again. And I mean, it's like one of those profound moments in your life where you're like, every part of me wants to go up. And I'm having to go down now one more time and wait another week.
And especially knowing how hard you fought to get to that that higher point.
The idea of going down through that icefall was rough. But, you know, there's nothing to do. It's like you can wish as much as you want, but the reality of the situation, dictates what you got to do.
I want to let everybody hear another clip from the documentary Farther Than the Eye Can See. And in this one, we get to listen to you as you reach the summit, and then you are told to get out of there because I guess there's some bad weather coming in.
Good job, Nick.
Thank you.
Good job, buddy. You did it. You did it.
Eric, Eric Weinberg, you copy? What's up, TV? Congratulations. I'm a little nervous. The weather seems to be changing. We're going to get out of here. But you're the strongest man in the world. You're the toughest student on the planet. Listen, take a couple minutes. Get off the summit. Over. Okay, we're out of here. Thanks. Get off the sun. The weather is changing. It's starting to build from the south. Over.
An incredible moment, to be sure. And if you'd like to speak with one of the people who did that, stand at the top of the world, our number is 1-800-423-8255. So I have to ask, okay, you got there. What did it feel like?
It's a retrospective sport because you have a moment to say, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm here. And then you got to get down. Because most of the accidents happen on the way down. So it's like this sort of concentration game. It's weird. You have to, you know, it doesn't matter how many good steps you take. If you take one bad step on a mountain, it could be your last. The mountain doesn't tolerate it. So you just have to, I mean, it's not like you have to be that great an athlete. You just have to be able to focus when you have to. And on high mountains, it's intense concentration. Where to put your left foot, where to put your right foot. There's not a whole bunch of celebrating until you're down.
Mm. And also, this was nighttime, right? So in some sort of peculiar sense, did you have an advantage doing this in the dark where your friends may have been struggling a bit more?
Well, I told you about my fear at altitude, but I was also counting on sort of unexpected things. And I guess I've learned to count on unexpected things. And I predicted these things. And I knew that when I got up high, even though the terrain was going to be steep, it'd be closer for me. Once I get my hands and feet on something, I feel way more in balance than when I'm just on my feet. And it's steep enough up there that I knew that would happen. And that did happen. I started moving really... I was the fast guy on the team. And because everyone else is just struggling for breath, and it takes them so long to take a step that, you know, I had plenty of time to think about where I wanted to place my next foot. And also, it's dark, so everyone else on my team are struggling to see through their headlamps, and I'm, you know, like, guys, you know, suck it up. That's the, that's the way it always is for me. So, and then the other thing is that the oxygen masks are sighted people choose small oxygen masks. They pull them below their chins because they're afraid the pure oxygen in the mask is going to blow up and freeze the inside lenses of their goggles. When they take those goggles off to clear them, it's so cold they go blind. Their corneas freeze. They go temporarily blind. And I never had to clear my goggles. So, you know, it's not like I had advantages up there, but I think you just sort of figure out what you have. How can I do what I want in my life with what you have? You know, don't worry about the stuff you don't have. Just learn to use the stuff you have.
Words to live by for sure. I'm Gail Harris, and you're listening to The Connection from NPR. Let's go back to our phone lines now and hear from Al, who's on the line from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hello, Al.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Eric.
Hi.
I had a couple of questions. The first one was, do you sort of feel like because you never had, I also have a degenerative disorder, and I sort of feel like it's been a lot easier for me to deal with losing my vision because I never had perfect vision. I've had some friends who sort of had I have a form of RP, and some of them have forms of RP where, you know, it sort of hits them all at once. And since I've had it since birth, I sort of feel like it's been easier to adjust to being blind because of never knowing what it was like to be able to see, so you never really learned to rely on your vision.
Right.
And the other question I had is, I had heard you had a Fidelco guide dog, which I also have, and I wanted to know what you did with your guide dog when you climbed Everest, because I know Levi would kill me if he saw me climbing the rock.
Well, good questions. Yeah, I think it is a bit easier in a way. You know, I see a lot of people who go blind in their older life, and it's much harder on them because they establish all the things they like to do well, and then they had all their habits, they had everything formed, and now they have to kind of relearn things. And I think that must be really hard. For me, I was at 13, I was trying to figure out what I was good at, and I was going blind at the same time. So that sort of, the two got intertwined, and I started reaching to find new things that I would be able to do as a blind person. And it's obviously any kind of thing like that happens to you like that, it's a huge adjustment, you know, and you go through those moments where they're dark, you know, but you learn to rebound, you learn to push beyond it. And I think that's what the resilience of people do. I mean, I don't think I'm any different from anyone else. In terms of the second thing, yeah, I do have a guide dog, and I left him at home. And it's funny because lots of people don't get what climbing Everest is about or climbing mountains. They always say, you know, hey, did you bring your dog with you? And I think it's funny, you know, it's like, you know, one guy asked me one time, who summited first, you or your dog? And I guess I haven't created an oxygen mask to fit my dog's snout yet, so he stayed home and got a vacation.
Pity.
Yeah.
Al, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Emily now, who's on the line from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Hi, Eric. I saw you when you were on the Oprah program, and
right.
I'm also familiar with mountain climbing from having read Into Thin Air, which was published several years ago, which was really wonderful, interesting accounting of climbing Mount Everest in storms. But I have a particularly difficult question for you, Eric. You have gotten a lot of press for having ascended Mount Everest, and you have just started alluding to the amount of help that other people have had to give you in order to accomplish this goal.
Yes.
And I personally think that climbing Mount Everest is an ego trip.
Sure.
And that's fine, and a lot of people are into ego trips. But in the bigger picture, I personally think your ascendance of Mount Everest causes problems for those of us, like me, who are visually handicapped and are struggling to get through a standard everyday life, getting children to and from activities to schools, dealing with households, and when someone who has a serious handicap and being totally blind or seriously visually handicapped is a real problem, accomplishes these kind of things, I think people then wonder, well, why are you having, you know, just a standard person who's not doing these things, having so much trouble just getting your kids across town and back in the space of 20 minutes when everybody else who can drive
sure.
can do it?
That's a great question, and you've tapped into a lot of things that I think are very important. One is that climbing Everest is a bit of an ego trip. Climbing mountains is an ego trip. I mean, you're putting yourself on the top of a mountain. And obviously, anytime you do that, it's an ego trip. And so you worry, you know, what's the purpose of this? What's the point of it? You know, I have a family that I've left behind at home, and I'm here 3 months climbing this mountain. I'm risking my life. I didn't think it was a crazy risk, but climbing Everest, there are objective dangers that you can't avoid. So it is, I wish I had an answer to that. I will say this, though. I think climbing mountains may have been a tiny bit less appealing to me if I could see, because for our climb, I think climbing Mount Everest as a blind person, even though I don't climb to prove that blind people can do this or that, I mean, I climb because I actually enjoy it. I think a blind person standing on top of Everest takes people's perceptions of what's possible and what's not, and I think it shatters it into a million pieces. And what happens when those people have to rebuild their perceptions of what's possible, opportunities get created in life. Things get expanded. It sort of awakens the possibilities in people. And I think that that's a good thing. Years ago, blind people struggled with having low expectations. And now if you have to struggle with people having high expectations, in my opinion, that's an improvement.
All right, Emily, thank you so much for the call. Adversity can be a roadblock or a reason to try harder. What do you think about where that kind of drive comes from? Does it exist because of adversity or in spite of it? We invite you to join us when we come back, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. Why climb the mountain if you can't see it? Well, when Eric Weinmayer set out to conquer Mount Everest, there was a whole chorus of doubters saying he'd never make it. They don't have too much to say right now. Eric Weinmayer is joining me in the studio. And one of the things I want to ask you about is the fact that you insisted on carrying your own gear, even at Everest, and even though having that burden may have slowed you down a bit. Now, there are many people with sight who use Sherpas with no apologies to help with the gear. So what made you reluctant to do that?
When I was 16 and I was just starting to climb, there was a blind person who climbed a tall mountain and got some press. And I thought that was really cool, except that the thing that bugged me was the fact that her sons were climbers, and they carried her pack for her and set up tents. And I thought, that's really cool, but if I climb, I want to take the next step. I want to actually not just put my life in the hands of other sighted people, but I want sighted people to put their life in my hands. I want to be one of the reasons why the team gets a few feet higher up the mountain each day. You know, I want to be able to point to things that I've done that have helped the team succeed. And so I've always tried to do that. You know, I've tried to set up tents, and I've tried to carry weight in my packs, as much weight as other people, because I want respect from my team. To me, that's the ultimate compliment, is when your team respects you and trusts you.
But in some sense, are the Sherpas kind of the unsung heroes here? I mean,
for sure. They are the lifeblood of any Himalayan expedition. The Sherpas, maybe because of better nutrition, they're getting taller. But they're still a little bit smaller than Westerners. But they carry twice as much gear. They go twice as fast, twice as far. They're absolutely amazing. And it's sort of this culture that they wind up doing the riskiest part of the work. And for me, I haven't really focused as much in on that, because everyone relies on Sherpas, whether you're sighted or blind. So for me, you know, if everyone's going to rely on the Sherpas, that's sort of a standard way that people climb the Himalayas now. I just didn't want to do it differently than the sort of the standard practice of the time.
You have a great analogy about that, about how you didn't want to go up to the mountain and...
Oh, yeah. I've said that I don't want to be some token blind guy just getting dragged to the summit and spiked on top like a football. I think anybody can do that. In fact, my friends will tease me. They'll call me the sack of potatoes because they know I hate that analogy. They know I hate the idea of ever being dragged up a mountain. And so they'll tease me and they'll call me a sack of potatoes. And you know, guys tease each other back and forth. Mm. My friends are always teasing me and I always tease them back.
Well, it's certainly hard to imagine you as a couch potato. I have to tell you that, Eric. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina now and hear from Rafe. Hi, Rafe.
Hello. How are you? Thank you. I'm obviously a great admirer of what he's accomplished. And having been a climber and a diver and a lot of things myself and never even touched the lip of where he's been, the question you posed a while ago about this idea of adversity being the linchpin that gets him or anyone, a child who's been abused or people who carry burdens, over into a different world of achievement is something that I'd like to hear him speak to. It's a world that I have a little bit of insight into, but not anything that I can philosophically or even mm-hmm. in conversation speak to, but your accomplishments and the depth of the affliction that you've carried, you've made into an asset. And I'd mm-hmm. like to hear your thoughts on that, because I think it can be instructive to anyone who goes through life having lived with something that's, quote-unquote, less than a perfect right. world.
I think that's a super fascinating question. I bet you someday scientists will actually study that, because it seems like when you just look at people who have lost a parent or at a young age or gone through some kind of traumatic experience, either they sink or they swim, or they swim really well. It seems like they lots of people find ways of rising above themselves. And I've met disabled people, and I'm in sort of the disabled world of sports, so this is what I know. My friend Mark Wellman fell down a mountain in the Sierra Nevadas and paralyzed himself. And after that, he invented a way of connecting a pull-up bar to a rope, and somebody goes up and anchors the rope, and he slides this pull-up bar up the rope and pulls himself up the rope, and he climbed El Capitan, this 3,300-foot rock face. They estimated about 7,000 pull-ups in 7 days to get there. My buddy Hugh Herr, who's a double-leg amputee, he lives in Boston, and he after he lost his legs, became an engineer, a PhD, and developed these prosthetic legs with special rubber feet that he can jam into cracks. One, he has a pair that he can use to stand up on ledges the width of a dime. He's actually became a better climber after he lost his legs than he was beforehand.
Yeah.
And you see this time and time again. And I call these people alchemists, you know, these medieval sorcerers able to turn lead into gold. It's like they're able to take just everything bad that comes at them, and they're able to somehow transform it into something, you know, really good. For me, my first role model was this, besides my parents and my brothers and my sister, was this guy named Terry Fox, who lost a leg to cancer. He was a Canadian, and he ran across Canada. And I just thought, man, there's a light inside every one of us.
Yeah.
Rafe?
Yeah, I'm here.
Do you have another thought?
Well, my thoughts go to the less visible and the less... in a sense, dramatic, and those are the psychologically damaged that somehow, instead of becoming, well, some of them do become mass murderers. They do awful things, and they act out in massive ways what has gone on in their minds. But the others, in fact, use that same, whatever it is, that key that gets turned in the mind, in the spirit that he's just talked about, and accomplish tremendous things that are almost as equally as commanding as climbing a mountain blind.
All right, Rafe, we take your point, and thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina now, and hear from Jennifer. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say thanks so much for doing what you did because, you know, we need people like you. I know that I've got all of my facilities intact. I'm perfectly healthy, and it's amazing the things that I'm afraid to do in life. And we need people like you in all areas just to be role models to inspire us. And I guess that sort of leads into my question, me saying I'm a scaredy cat. I mean, I'm wondering, do you ever have moments where you're just like, oh, my God, what am I doing? Where something's happened specifically, but where you're just like, I cannot believe this. Am I insane?
Yeah, I think that's great because when I was growing up, I was the kind of person that when I would get afraid, I would literally get paralyzed. I'd pick up a cup and I'd drop it. I'd sweat, like, you know, my hands would shake. It's that paralyzing fear. And over the years, I've learned to translate that fear into focus, you know, and climbing has helped me do that. You're coming down the mountain in some terrible storm and you're thinking, I could be panicking right now, but what would it accomplish? It's this ability that you learn to take uncontrollable situations and bring them under control. It's a very wonderful and peaceful thing that you can do in your mind. I've tried to do that. I think people who do, you know, really exciting things like climbing Mount Everest, for instance, at least speaking from my experience, I always am afraid. And 100 times a day, I doubt myself and I think, what am I doing here? Maybe I bit off too much. Maybe, you know, I don't belong here. Maybe those people are right. You know, you think those thoughts. And I think there's a Sherpa quote, which is just beautiful. They say the nature of mind's like water. If you do not disturb it, it will become clear. And what you got to do is just sort of push out all that distraction, all that crazy sort of doubts and fears, and you just have to let your mind be still like water and just focus. And that's what I've found. That's what I've tried to do. But, yeah, those doubts always creep into your brain. That's just the way it is. You know, there's no voice in my head that says you're going to be okay, you're going to be fine. You know, you've made the right decision.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. I want to ask about the impact becoming a father has had on you. Although first I need to tell everybody that you're listening to The Connection from NPR. Your little girl is now 3. She
Yes.
was a few months old when you made the Everest climb. Now that she's a little older, or just in general, has becoming a father and seeing her grow to this point made you a little less, you know, ready to get out there and take the big risks?
Yeah. When Emma was 6 months old, that's when I went to Everest. People might think, oh, that's crazy to go with a young baby. But my wife and I made the decision to actually go at that time because at that age, Emma wasn't super aware of things beyond her mama. And so we thought that that was the perfect time for me to go. If I was ever going to go, that was it. I mean, as she gets older and she's verbal and able to say, Daddy, don't leave, that's when it's going to be really hard. So these days, yeah, I've toned it down. It's not like I don't love climbing, but as I've gotten older, I have to be honest. I mean, I sit in a tent thinking about the summit, the long summit day ahead, and I think maybe this is a selfish thing that I'm doing. And so because of that, I've toned my climbs down. I want to be with my family more. I want to be there with my daughter. And so my trips are like 2 weeks. I've changed my philosophy of climbing to something climbers call light and fast. You know, you do lower altitude climbs where you don't have to acclimatize, and you try to move as quickly as you can up a very technical rock face or ice face, and you know you can be there and back in a week. Mm-hmm. And I feel pretty comfortable with that kind of climbing these days. But it's going to be a while before I'm away on a high Himalayan peak for 3 months. I don't think that's going to happen.
Eric, we have time for one more call. Let's go to Salem, Massachusetts, and hear from Steve. Hello, Steve. Welcome.
Good morning. Hi. I enjoy listening to your guest, and I just wondered, I'm a father myself, a new father of a little girl who's almost 2, and unfortunately she has, I don't know if I'd say unfortunately, but she has cerebral palsy, and right now we're sort of finding out what she's going to be capable of. She's, you know, doing therapy and stuff like that. What I wanted to know was whether the guest had any advice as to ways to make possibilities open up for her and ways to have her, you know, what does he plan to do with his daughter in terms of, I don't want to make her expectations too high, but on the other hand, I don't want to hold her back.
Right.
And I'll take my question off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
I think that's a great question. As a parent, you're the greatest advocate for your kid than anyone in the world. And whether a kid has high expectations or low expectations will depend on how you act, not on the way what you say, but on how you act. And so if you're the kind of parent that gets out there and pushes hard and tries to accomplish things and you're the kind of parent that loves your daughter very, very much and shows that, then I think your kids grow up to be that kind of person. It's a lot about actions. But yeah, you're going to have to sort of be like my mom I called her a mother lioness. You have to sort of fight for those opportunities for your kid and just not sort of be ready to say that's impossible. But to sort of keep an open mind and say, you know, I want to see if this is possible. I want to try it. You know, we don't know if she's going to be able to do this, but we're sure going to try.
Good advice, Eric. We just have a bit of time left, so I have to ask. You said you're taking shorter trips. What's next for you? You've done Everest. I mean, there is that question. There are no higher mountains to climb.
Well, there are steeper mountains and out there, but yeah, so lots of climbs around the world. But maybe the most important thing I'm doing, I've been in contact with a lady named Sabria who's blind. She's from Germany. And we're kindred spirits, I guess, in a way. About 10 years ago, she applied for all these human rights jobs in third world countries. I said, we don't send blind people overseas. You know, it's a liability. So she went over to Tibet and created a school for the blind herself. She rides horseback into these villages and finds these kids who are blind who haven't been taught to walk. You know, they're 7, 8 years old. Parents just don't know what to do with them, you know. And and she said, why don't you come over here and visit my school? And I said, well, let's do one step more. Let's go over, train your kids how to climb, and take maybe 6 of your best, strongest kids up a high peak in Tibet. So we picked a 23,000-foot peak, and to get those blind kids to the top of that is going to, I think, really change what it means to be disabled, not just, you know, like Everest, but around the world for everyone.
Well, many thanks to you, Eric.
Thank you.
Eric Weinmayer is an adventurer, a mountaineer, and the author of Touch the Top of the World. Terrific book, by the way. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection.